Welcome to the Special Sauce Podcast, real conversations about food and life, hosted by Serious Eats founder, Ed Levine.
The beauty in the food that we make here, it's a family effort, it's a collaborative effort, but it's also something that we like put our heart and soul into, and I feel like that's what you're tasting. You know, you're tasting that authenticity.
Amanda Mack opened up her family-inspired bakery in the middle of the pandemic. YouTube food star Adam Ragusa offers some sage advice to holiday bakers everywhere, and Kenji participates in a holiday cookie swap with a broken oven. All coming up on the holiday baking episode of Special Sauce. It is my distinct pleasure and an honor, really, to introduce Amanda Mack, the head baker and owner of Crust by Mack in Baltimore, Maryland. So good to have you on Special Sauce to be able to tell your amazing story. Welcome, Amanda.
Hello. Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
So even though this is our holiday baking episode, we first need to hear how you got to opening Crust by Mack, your first bakery in the middle of the pandemic. Let's start with how and where did you grow up?
I actually grew up in a little small community right here in the city. It is called McCullough Homes. It's a little small project community. Me and my whole family actually grew up there. My grandmother still lives there to this day. It was a bunch of us, tons of grandkids in a small little house, just having a great time, actually.
And what kind of baking, both holiday and otherwise, went on in your house?
Oh, my goodness. So my grandmother always had a house full of kids, and she would be crack of dawn. So fresh biscuits was always a thing. She would make them from scratch. Oh, my goodness. And she used to use the mason jar, and you could just hear the suction from the jar in the dough. It was, like, so nostalgic. So fresh biscuits, fresh cakes, fresh yeast rolls. The whole house always smelled delicious.
You and your grandmother, her husband, your mother, you all grew up in the same house.
Oh, yeah. And it doesn't stop there. My mother's sister and then all of her kids. So my aunt had four kids. My mom had three. And then they were the siblings. So it was a lot of us. I don't even know how we fit.
Wow.
But it never felt like it wasn't enough space when I was growing up.
And you said it was the neighborhood that they shot a lot of The Wire in, right?
Oh, yeah. We could look out back of my aunt's house and see them filming. My grandmother, too. We all live, like, right in the same community. That's how I ended up being an extra on The Wire, like, almost a dozen times.
But no speaking role.
No speaking role. I mean, you know, they could have gave me a little something.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit more about your grandmother, who is just about as big a part of your story as you are.
Right? So it's so funny because I'm always calling people like queen. I always say like, hey, queen, you know, when people come, hey, king. But honestly and truly, my grandmother is the queen. She has her chair. She sits in. It's like a throne. And everyone comes. It's so funny. They're like, oh, my goodness, it's the grandmother. They're like swarming in to see her. She just taught me everything I know. I was not professionally trained. She actually went to culinary school. She worked for some of Baltimore's like earliest restaurants, and she had just been cooking all of her life. So a lot of the things that I learned were like grandmother taught. I say that all the time. Like, you have self-taught and you have grandmother taught, and that's what I was. And a lot of my recipes are actually inspired by childhood memories and things that happened like growing up. She's definitely a huge inspiration. It's one of the reasons we sell biscuits here by the dozen, because that's what I actually grew up on. And she makes apple butter for the bakery. It's a family business, and she's definitely like at the head of the table. Everything we do is like an homage to her and the things that she's created and the legacy that she has built. So I just try to pay honor to her because we're in different times and she's finally getting the roses she deserves. I'm just so happy I can actually facilitate that and help her get that.
And she's still working at the bakery.
Absolutely. Absolutely. She is working with me. You know what's so crazy? For Thanksgiving, we launched our Thanksgiving orders. We sold out in 3 days. We were up for 48 hours straight. My grandmother never left the kitchen. And that's usually how it is all the time. She's just right there beside me doing what needs to be done. And I'm talking about every step of the way, from prep to getting it in the oven to finishing. She's always involved. And I think that that's something that is the beauty in the food that we make here. It's a family effort. It's a collaborative effort. But it's also something that we like put our heart and soul into. And I feel like that's what you're tasting. You know, you're tasting that authenticity.
What kinds of pies did you make for Thanksgiving and how many did you sell?
Oh my gosh. 292 pies. We had a classic apple caramel lattice pie. Then we had a classic sweet potato. And then we had my favorite of all, which was the double crusted yam pie. And it came with a side of brown sugar pumpkin butter.
Whoa. A double-crusted
yam pie,
which is slightly different than sweet potato pie. A lot of people don't know that sweet potatoes and yams are not one and the same.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So tell us about your not all that circuitous path to professional baking. You went off to college, right?
Yes, I went off to college. Ended up getting pregnant and coming back home. I have like a really supportive family. So they were actually willing to like help me. We were thinking about moving up, finding a small apartment in Frostburg, but then just realized like it's better to just be like back home. So my husband and I, we came back home. I was doing editing for publications and ghostwriting and all kinds of things, making almost six figures. I feel like I'm getting paid, but what am I really doing? This is not sustaining me.
Yeah, you're going backwards.
Yes, like I'm not really doing anything. And my husband, he's doing everything that he needs to do so that I can lead this creative life. But I just was like, I wanted to do something that was more community forward, just going back to my roots, being around my community and my family made me feel closest to home. So I just dove into like community gardening, food justice, working with some local CSAs. I did some nutrition education and did market tours. I worked with the state to develop some programs for people on SNAP and worked with WIC and stuff like that. So it just kind of took me onto a path where I started to realize that community is my mission. You know, family is something that I think about in all aspects of my life. And I wanted my work to mirror my passions. So that's how I kind of got into food. I was like, started volunteering on local farms and got some contract work with Johns Hopkins School of Public Health, developed some programs there, and it just was nonstop. I never looked back.
Yeah. You also ran a coffee shop.
I managed a cafe bakery in Reservoir Hill. That really transformed my mind when it came to being of service to community through food. And the beauty of the bakery cafe was that they allowed us to use our passions and put them to work. So the things that I thought about and I talked about, like food access and food justice, like the cafe sponsored those efforts to make sure that we were able to be of service to our community. I started a lot of the work there. And once I decided I wanted to do my own thing, I kind of just carried that with me because that is a part of who I am. So I've never stopped. You know, I just kept on going. And some of the people who actually worked with me at the bakery cafe are here with me at Crust.
So after spending years in the food business, you decide to go for it, open your own place. The only problem was it turned into the middle of the pandemic.
It really was like a nightmare. And I felt like for so long, we were just leading up to this big moment because we're literally built this place from scratch. There was nothing here. We built the big shop. Like, how do you want the floors to look? How do you want the countertops? Like, we're building a blank space and you're watching your dream and your baby just grow and come to life. And then all of a sudden, you're just at a standstill.
Did your landlord cut you a break?
Absolutely. They were like, they're the best, honestly. as soon as we found out that we were definitely like not opening, they were just like, well, what do you want to do? Like, we want to help you make money, because it's like, okay, things are closed, but we still have to, like, we've hired people. And, you know, we were literally on the brink of opening within a week of the shutdown. So they waived all the fees, like we didn't have to pay anything. And they also allowed us to be able to operate in the space in a limited capacity. So we could do like curbside, we can do deliveries, but I was able to still use my kitchen and, you know, things like that. So we were able to make money in a sense, but not have to put it right back into the business, because we didn't know how long we would be going like this. Yeah, so it was a blessing.
I wish there were more stories like yours when it comes to landlord-tenant relationships in business during the pandemic, because I know there are a lot of stories like yours, but there are also a lot of stories where the landlord is not particularly supportive.
We're all in this together is the motto here, because we're all like doing this from day one from scratch. And it's great to know that we're supported and that they care about us and our success and the future of our business.
And then if it wasn't enough that you were opening Crust by Mac in the middle of a pandemic in a new marketplace, at the end of May, George Floyd was murdered. How did his murder affect you?
I think it definitely was a trigger for me. You know, a few weeks before that, Ahmaud was murdered. So it was just a combination of things. And we're still like recovering from Freddie Gray. Like there is still no justice. You know what I'm saying? It's just a constant reminder that us as Black people are not safe. And it was hard for me because this year my son just turned 13. He went from being a child to now a teenager. And once again, I had to explain to him what had happened. It's really challenging when you're growing up and you feel like you're not safe. And when I feel like I can't protect my child, no matter what, when my husband feels like he can't protect his child or he can't protect himself because we're already targeted, right? It was a lot for me to work through that. And because most of the time I'm baking with my heart instead of my hands, I was at a place where I just was stuck. I just felt stagnant. So I'm really big on social media. I'm very transparent. And I just made a statement that I just couldn't open it. Even though the market is very supportive and we all are like family, the reality that I was opening up in a place where no one else looked like me or could understand or relate to the experiences or the depth of the feelings that I felt in that moment, it was hard for me to come into this place.
We're going to leave Amanda Mack's story right here. Later in the episode, we'll find out how her grandmother implored her to keep pursuing her dream, even in the shadow of George Floyd's murder. House, or should I say, in both of our houses, we have Adam Ragusea, a former journalism professor, podcaster, and reporter turned YouTuber, in what's the typical overnight sensation on YouTube, his 10 years. You've been on YouTube for 10 years, right, Adam?
Well, I mean, I had like thrown up some random videos to host them there for no particular reason. But in December of 2018, I just threw up a pizza making video for fun. And then it randomly went viral March of 2019. And here we are. Hi, I'm Adam Ragusea, failed musician turned internet cook. And here's 10 things that we can all learn about food and cooking from the mighty Van Halen. Thing number one, everybody wants some.
Oh, yes!
Anyway, his fundamentally optimistic but slightly edgy food and cooking videos on YouTube have more than 1 million subscribers, right?
Yep,
which is pretty awesome. Some of his videos involve baking everything from pizza to cookies. We thought he'd be a great person to talk to for our holiday baking episode of Special Sauce. Plus, he seems like a pretty cool person that would be right at home here. Anyway, so welcome to Special Sauce, Adam.
Thanks for having me, Ed. I appreciate it. In fact, I just got my Christmas cookie video in the can last night.
That's great. So now let's talk about baking. Sure. First of all, tell us about the holiday baking traditions that you grew up with.
I grew up with just a great one. My folks would do these Christmas cookie decorating parties. And I wonder where they got the idea from. But basically, my dad would make stacks as high as the ceiling of roll-out sugar cookies in festive shapes. And he'd freeze them because it would take him like weeks to bake a sufficient quantity in advance. Throw them in this kind of chest freezer we had in the basement. And then my parents, all of their adult friends who had kids around, you know, the same age as me and my brother, they would invite everybody over about a week before Christmas, maybe a giant party at our house. And everyone would decorate Christmas cookies. They'd lay out huge tables in all of the rooms of the downstairs covered in wax paper and kids and grownups and just icing everywhere in the carpet and the curtains, you know, just absolute pandemonium. And it was delightful. It was so great. And I can't wait for the plague to be over and I can try to revive that tradition with my own family in our own home. I'll need a bigger house. Mine is too small for that. But it was just delightful. It was so great. And then there were some other things, like my mom always made pumpkin bread several times, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. Love a good soft pumpkin bread loaf. She would also make those, what are those extruded cookies called? The ones you push through a little thing that looks like you're going to caulk a shower with it. She would make those. I've tried to make those, too sticky. I can't make it work. But those are super tasty. All kinds of really happy memories. Good stuff.
That's amazing. And before the pandemic, did you in fact do those kinds of things for you and your wife and your young sons?
I've decorated roll-out sugar cookies, as far as I know, every year I've been alive, and definitely done that with the kids. Haven't had a big party with a whole bunch of people over. Kids probably too young for that, but once they get a little older, I hope to get that tradition going.
What are you going to do this year for the holidays, Adam, and has the pandemic affected what you're going to do?
I just did a video for traditional rollout decorated Christmas cookies and had a delightful time shooting with my kids for that. Always kind of tricky because I don't like to show their faces. And so getting camera angles of just heads and cookies is always a little bit challenging, but that was a lot of fun. The mess afterward, just epic. But that's as it is meant to be. It just stinks that we can't do all the things. And I know that next year it's probably all going to be better and we can get back with our families and celebrate and fight and drink will flow and blood will spill. And if the boys want to fight, you better let them. But next year, not this year.
It seems like myth busting is a big part of what you do. And since we're talking about baking, I'm thinking of your box cake versus made from scratch video, which I love, which you also showed off your reporting chops, by the way, Adam.
You know, I do two videos a week. Thursday is a recipe video. Monday is some other kind of video about food. And I consider those journalism. I wouldn't say that they're inspired by journalism. I think they are journalism. And myth busting, I try to pursue that art, not in the sort of gleeful, iconoclastic, toppling the edifice of authority kind of thing, but I just want to relieve all of us of delusions that we suffer under, you know, things that we are told we have to do or have to put up with when in fact we don't, because cooking is like any kind of inherited wisdom thing where all kinds of orthodoxy gets entrenched for the simplest reason being that most things work. Right? Like you can do it so many different ways and they all work. But if you've done it one way most of the time and gotten a satisfactory result, you get it in your head that that's the only way or that there are certain steps that you have done that are essential. Whereas in fact, you haven't done what a scientist would do where you isolate variables, right? And that's totally understandable. You're a cook, you're not a freaking scientist. But the more recent development has been the professionalization of the culinary arts and the culinary arts rocketing up in social standing, where now it's a profession with a capital P. And my whole time on YouTube, I've gotten angry comments from chefs who kind of act as though I'm practicing medicine without a license. And the thing is, I want to emphasize that I, in fact, massively respect their profession with a capital P. I'm glad that they get respect as professionals because I think they deserve it. On the other hand, just because that's how you've always done it in your restaurant doesn't mean that that's the only way that it can be done. And in fact, a lot of the things that you do are demonstrably unnecessary. Like that pizza making video, you know, I get so many people who were furious at me for putting the salt into the water in which I had bloomed the yeast rather than adding the salt into the flour. They're saying like the salt is going to kill the yeast. And there's a logical scientific reason to suspect that that might be true, to hypothesize that, right? Salt is antimicrobial. Salt will kill you. If I packed you up in salt, Ed, and left you for a while, like you would not survive that. But if I sprinkle a little bit of salt on your arm, you're going to be just fine, right? Salt is only deadly in sufficient concentration and with sufficient duration of exposure. And you can just demonstrably see, you don't have to believe me, go in your kitchen, put a bunch of salt into your yeast water, leave it there for 2 hours, and then bake your bread. It's going to come out the same. And so we labor under a lot of those misconceptions. And I use the word labor intentionally because they cause more work for us. And I'm all about efficiency. And that's the other thing I sort of get. My critics accuse me of laziness all the time. And in the time of COVID, I'm reminded people who confuse efficiency for laziness are like the people who confuse caution and prudence for cowardice. It's not the same thing. Like there's no point in wasting energy whether you're lazy or not. And people who know me know that I'm not lazy. In fact, I'm a workaholic in a bad way. Like, I'm not proud of that. That's a bad thing about me.
Related to that is you're also kind of a substance over style and taste over appearance kind of cook.
Well, only in the sense that I want to help people give themselves permission to make delicious, ugly food, or to open themselves to the possibility that they may be satisfied by that. Again, I think with the rise of professional food media and cooking becoming this kind of aspirational lifestyle programming, it's just the HGTVification of dinner, right? Where a house can't just be like a comfortable place where you live, but it's gotta be just so and stylish and all that kind of crap. You know, like macaroons, like French macaroons, which, by the way, I'm calling it macaroon, not macaron. We can get back to that if you want. But anyways, a French macaroon, like 5-6 years ago, I sort of went through like a phase where I made 35 pans of macaroons a week, trying to get them just so perfectly domed, no cracks, those little feet on them, the cute little feet, right? Because for some reason, I'd gotten it in my head that that was a good use of my time and that that would make me happy, but it did not. And when I realized that all of these pans that are ugly have all tasted really good, and it's not just about opening yourself up to ugly food, it's also opening yourself up to unpredictable food, food that comes out a little bit different every time. Because like you can mess with the proportions with French macaroons and you'll get ones that are sort of almost like cotton candy-ish. You'll get ones that are more chewy and cookie-ish and everything in between, or you get ones that are almost kind of like brownies. And they're all good. Every single one of them I enjoyed. All good. And they don't have to be the same every time. And in fact, that's kind of what makes cooking at home so fun and so nice, is that it's unpredictable. If I want factory precision, I will buy it from a factory.
No, that was what was great about your macaroon video. Is like I looked at the imperfect ones, at the kind of funky ones, and maybe because I have a long history in jazz and improvisation, you know, it's like, I like those.
With something like a cookie, if it's not perfectly round, you get like a little bit kind of jutting out tangentially. That part goes crispier than the rest, and it's good. It's a fun contrast up until the point at which it's not, right? If it gets to the point where it actually like burns, then that's bad, and you want to rein it in.
So tell me about the holiday cookie video you just did.
It was funny. I sort of had mentioned on social media that I was going to do it. Somebody replied and said, like, so are you going to like show us how to make sugar cookies that aren't so plain? And I'm like, if it wasn't plain, it wouldn't be a sugar cookie. Literally, the only difference between sugar cookies and other cookies is that they are unflavored other than vanilla, right? And have no chunks. That is the only thing that defines a sugar cookie. And so I was like, no. I think people are so conditioned by cooking media to expect that someone like me would be having a twist. Or if I don't have a clever twist, it would be some kind of the ultimate, the very, very best version of this thing. And no. You don't get that with me. This is not the ultimate. It's good enough. You know, I say at the beginning, there are a billion recipes for rollout sugar cookies on the internet. I'm sure they almost all work great. This is the one from my wife's grandma, Sherstrom, and we're going to make this one today. And the only thing we're going to change is we're going to cut the ingredient quantities in half, because if you pull out these old holiday baking recipes from your mom's chest, they make huge quantities because they're calibrated for days when people's families were way bigger. I cut her recipe in half and it still made 4 dozen cookies.
Right, especially now during the pandemic.
Well, that too, exactly.
You are, by definition, cooking for the four of you.
And I think that this explains to a great extent kind of the rise in popularity of the air fryer. And I love it. I mean, I hate the name, but everything else about that product, like, I love. And it's such a reflection of how household size has evolved in the developed world. We're just living in much smaller households, and we don't need a giant oven for most meals anymore. I encourage people, through encouraging myself, to reassess all kinds of traditions and realize that traditions were formed for a particular context, and that as contexts change, it's okay to let the tradition change.
Yeah, exactly. So what's the one single piece of advice that you would give to bakers this holiday season?
Chill. It's not a performance. You have nothing to prove to anybody. Chillax. It's all okay. If it makes you happy, if you like it, if it tastes good, that's literally all that matters. Your prowess is not being judged. Just make what you like, let it be ugly, and have a great time.
Thank you, Adam, for coming on Special Sauce.
Thank you, Ed. It was a pleasure. I've admired your work for many years, and this was an honor.
And we will certainly have you back, and we wish you and your family a safe and healthy and delicious holiday season, man.
And to you, and to all.
Amanda Mack is back with us to share her story of opening a bakery in Baltimore during the pandemic. In the aftermath of the George Floyd murder that shook Baltimore and the entire country for that matter, she figured out a way to keep going. Her grandmother played a pivotal role in how she managed to carry on.
Everyone just extended support. And I'm talking about anyone from like bakers and pastry chefs to other business owners willing to say like, hey, listen, whatever you need, I'll come in and bake for you. I'll pack some boxes. I'll do anything you need, because you have come too far to not open this bakery in the midst of all of these things. So I just was like, wow, I was just so amazed by the outpouring of support I received. And it really just helped me to get through. And that day, the day before we opened, my grandmother came and she sat right here beside me. And we just kind of like slow walked our way through opening day prep. And by the end of the day, I kind of felt more like myself. And it was great. She always wants you to know that she's there for you and that you'll get through it, because her life was no crystal stair, you know, and she's been through it. And she says, if I can do it, you can do it. So I just keep that in my mind. You know, I come from a long line of strong women, you know, both of my grandparents, my mom, my aunt, like these are women. I see women. I see the strength and the resilience. And I'm not sure if you knew, but, you know, my mom just last year, we thought we would lose her to breast cancer. And it just wasn't looking good. The doctor basically told us, like, you need to start preparing. You need to get things in order. And we flew back home. And I had to like check myself in to the hospital. Like I had a mental breakdown because I could not imagine what my life would be like without her here, especially like opening a bakery, you know, like especially working with her and her catering company. It was just like I was doing this for all of us, and for her to possibly not be here to see that, it just took me to another place. But she's here. She is here cooking with me every week. It's just amazing.
So 3 generations of Mac and Roy's are like doing it, man. Who's going to stop the three of you?
I know, right? Nobody.
So Crust by Mac is now open on weekends, right?
And we just added Thursday. We're open Thursday through Sunday.
What do you make and how many are you selling now, like on the weekends?
Okay, so we're in the middle of a global pandemic. And week to week, it's like you don't know what to expect. But since we have been open, we've sold out every day. We've made more and more and more. We've hired, and now we're on our second round of hiring because we're just not making enough. This past weekend, we probably sold 3,000 cookies. So we're doing like hand pies. We specialize in hand pies, sweet and savory. We do cookies. We do biscuits. We do breads and cakes and cornbreads. We're just not making enough. So we sold almost 3,000 cookies between Thursday and Sunday, and we're only open from 9 a.m. to 3 p.m. And we only made it one day since we've been open in the past 6 months to 3 p.m. and not sold out. Every other day, we've sold out, probably at 1:30. The latest is probably 2:15, and it's gone.
That's crazy. And what holiday items are you selling? Are all those cookies, holiday cookies?
We're starting our holiday cookies next weekend, but they're just kind of like a mashup of all of our favorite things. We're doing this 12 days of Christmas. So each day we're open until Christmas Eve. It's a new featured favorite. So of course, we're like the home of the jumbo lump dip crab pie.
When I read about the jumbo lump crab pies, like all I know is that Amanda needs to send me one of those. I will pay anything.
It's so funny you said I will pay anything. They sell out in minutes. We used to do them every Sunday until crab season was over. And we just did them on our eighth day of Christmas. And people are like, I will do anything for this crab. It's so good. We just started doing a take and bake option for the biscuits. So you can buy those here frozen and take them home and bake. That was huge for Thanksgiving holiday. We had a holiday cookie that was featured in Bon Appetit. Our pecan pumpkin spice chocolate chip cookie, which was absolutely amazing. We did those too. So we're just, you know, bringing in the holiday cheer. We tried, we did the big thing for pumpkin season, and we did a big gingerbread thing this month. We actually just did the rollout with Guinness for their new gingerbread spice stout, which was huge. I was so excited. We went to the brewery, did a whole tour, drank all the beer. I needed to like have a huge pretzel before I left there.
And do you also sell cookie dough or just the cookies?
We did a lot of the cookie dough in the summer. So we're about to start doing that again, the take and bake. So the take and bake, we had the cookie dough and the biscuits. And we're going to be doing pie crust for Christmas. We're not doing any holiday pies for Christmas, but we're doing pie crust. So you can come buy the crust and make it yourself and pretend, you know, just pretend you did all the work.
That's amazing. What a journey you've been on.
Yeah.
What's the most important thing that A, you've learned about yourself, and B, what you've learned about the world on this journey?
I think the most important thing I've learned about myself is that I'm just someone who loves to support other people. Like, I'm real big on communion. One of the greatest things that I've learned is that generational wealth is important, but community wealth is even more important. So that is what we're building here. We're not just a bakery. Like, we're very community forward, and we want to grow, and we want people to grow with us.
So that you've learned about yourself, and what have you learned about the world?
I've learned that despite everything that's going on, the world really is just a happy place. You can talk about all the things that are happening in the world, but every week we have a new customer. We have new people that just show up and show out for us. Love is contagious. Energy is contagious. And we start our day with a positive attitude. We welcome positive energy and we receive that. People just want to come and be around things that make them feel good, whether that's food, whether that's people, whether that's music. They just want to be around good energy. So I just feel like the business has helped me see the world in a different way, and that we're all just looking for a little love. We're all just looking for a little happiness. And just sharing that has just been something that's been the most joyful thing.
You know, your story and your bakery, Crust by Mac, they're like baking vaccines. They offer all of us hope.
I love that. I really do. It's a dream come true. I just honestly did not see this for myself in any way. I didn't know how fulfilling it could be to just be yourself. And I feel like a lot of the times in the industry, you're looking at so many role models, you're looking to be like someone and to emulate things that you've seen and the success that you've seen from other people. But when you just stop and think about the things that make you happy and the things that you want to provide, I feel like you get to show up and be authentic.
Yeah. Yeah. It seems like authenticity and realness, they're sort of your overarching philosophy. Do you have a single piece of advice for folks who are baking for the holidays at home?
Yes. Take your time and enjoy. Savor the moment of baking. It's a very therapeutic thing. And I think with everything that's happening right now, it's nice to kind of like escape into something that you have control over from start to finish. We didn't know how 2020 was going to end. I realized a lot in baking that when you pour yourself into something, into a project, and it comes out and you just like have that first slice of a pie that you spent 3 hours making, it's just a little moment that you have with yourself. And it's just like, wow, like I did this. And I know it sounds like a small thing, but just being in control of something right now goes a long way. It really does. So just take some time and actually enjoy the experience of baking. You know, be intentional with the recipes that you're recreating. Be intentional with someone that you're sharing it with, because right now is really what's carrying us through. It's the hope that's carrying us through, because we don't know what we're walking into in 2020. So yeah, just have fun. You know, just have fun. It'll make all the difference.
Amanda Mac, thank you so much for sharing your extraordinary story, your grandmother's story, and the Crust by Mac story. We're going to have to get periodic progress reports.
We're going to have to get grandma in next time.
Exactly. Anyway, your special sauce, Amanda, is indeed special.
Thank you so much. This is so much fun.
You're listening to Special Sauce. I'm Ed Levine. It's time for a special holiday Ask Kenji with the author of Food Lab and Every Night is Pizza Night, J. Kenji Lopez-Alt. Hello, Kenji. This week, the Ask Kenji questions come from me. I have to admit it. I'm not too proud. First of all, I have to start by saying that, Kenji, you are an unlikely person to be asking questions about holiday baking.
I'm not much of a sweets person in general. I do like certain things. And two of my most popular recipes ever are baking recipes, my pie crust and my chocolate chip cookies. I spent a long time working, longer than I work on my normal recipes because I'm less familiar with baking, which I think sometimes helps me when I'm writing baking recipes.
But we do have to say that in the 900-page tome, The Food Lab, there is not one cookie recipe.
No, there's not. There's not much sugar in that book at all.
I think there's very little sugar. So my first question is, was there any holiday baking in your family growing up?
No, not really. We would have pie sometimes, but we didn't really do many sweets in general. Sometimes my mom would make cookies, I think, just for fun, but it wasn't like a regular thing. It definitely wasn't like a, we all get together and bake the way some families do, you know?
Yeah.
I remember she used to make, she called them Russian tea cakes. Maybe that's what they're really called, but they have a bunch of different names. You know, they're made with like ground up almonds and are coated in powdered sugar. And I think she had a New York Times recipe. You know, they're about the size of like a tablespoon and they're really dry and crumbly.
I know what you're talking about.
They're a bunch of different names, but that's what she called them. And I think she called them that because that's what some recipe from the New York Times in the 80s called it. I remember her making those and severely disliking them because they're so dry.
In your current household, first with Audrey and then with Audrey and your daughter, does much holiday baking take place?
You know, we did do some cookies you know, like stamped sugar cookies because Alicia had like shortbread. Alicia had like a bunch of dinosaur molds, cookie cutters. And so we made a bunch of dinosaur cookies. But it's just coincidental that it happened around the holidays. You know, we are doing this year, we're doing an exchange with our former neighbors and friends from San Mateo, who also have kids Alicia's age. So we're doing like a cookie exchange with a bunch of people. And so we're sending cookies around. And this year we were going to bake chocolate chip cookies, but then my brand new oven broke. It got locked shut. The self-cleaning cycle wasn't even on, but it locked itself shut. And then it shorted out. So like all the electrical components of it are broken. So I need to get that fixed. But it means we can't bake currently. So I think what we're going to end up doing is we're going to make fudge instead, which is stovetop. Significantly easier than cookies, actually. Many fewer ingredients. It's just basically condensed milk and chocolate. That's all you really need to make good fudge. You know, you could, of course, do it the old-fashioned way and get a candy thermometer and really monitor the temperature of your sugar and do all that difficult stuff. But the easiest way is either with a can of condensed milk or with a jar of marshmallow fluff and chocolate. And you just melt it together. And that's it.
You actually are a fudge lover, if I remember.
I do like chocolate. I wouldn't necessarily say I'm a fudge lover. Yeah, it's good. You know, it's good from time to time, especially when it's made with good chocolate. I'm more of a sort of a plain chocolate enjoyer. I've been enjoying it more recently, you know, over the last 10 years or so, my chocolate enjoyment has ramped up. I don't know why.
What's interesting about the fudge recipe, you know, a lot of people have been talking about sweets recipes that don't require a KitchenAid mixer. Fudge solves that problem.
All you need is a bowl and a pot of boiling water, like you make a double boiler. All you need is a bowl and a whisk and a baking sheet to set the fudge in, and that's it, basically. It's very, very simple. It takes half an hour. You let it chill overnight, you know, and then you cut it. But very few dishes to clean up, not too much measuring. Very kid-friendly because nothing gets super hot, so you're not like making candy where you could really burn yourself if you get the candy on yourself. But it's just, you know, in a double boiler, so nothing gets hotter than boiling water. And it's fun, yeah, because you can stir stuff into it.
This could become your holiday baking tradition.
I've definitely done fudge in the past. You know, this year we're doing it because the oven's broken, but in the past I've done it just because I was in a time crunch and I was like, oh shoot, there's all these people I need to send something to. Oh, I'll just make a giant batch of fudge, and people like homemade stuff.
Are you mixing in anything?
So Alicia said she wanted to put pine nuts in it, so we'll probably put pine nuts in it and maybe pistachios.
And your mother didn't grow up with any holiday baking traditions because she grew up in Japan, right?
New Year's is the most important holiday in Japan. And there, what they do is eat mochi, not the sweet kind that we're familiar with here, you know, like not the ice cream stuff, but like mochi, like their savory rice, sticky rice cakes that you grill with soy sauce and wrap in seaweed. We would do that every year for New Year's. My grandmother would make a ton of mochi and then grill it on the countertop. We had these little portable charcoal grills and you'd grill the mochi on top of that. And then your mom like stresses out because it's super sticky and kids get it stuck in their throat. Mochi was our sort of holiday tradition, and that was just on New Year's.
Remember the Serious Eats cookie swaps, the holiday cookie swaps?
Uh-huh.
Did you ever contribute?
Of course I did. I always contributed. I always brought a different batch of cookies to that. I don't remember what I brought specifically, but I'm sure it was a Serious Eats recipe if I made something. It was probably a recipe that leaned towards the savory side. Like I think one year I made rosemary and pine nut sablés on the site somewhere. I think I made those. You know, that was the year you and I went to, what's the name of the restaurant? Chispaca. They had this incredible butterscotch pudding that comes with little rosemary and pine nut sablé cookies. And I think I had those like, oh, these would be good for the holiday party. And so I made something like that.
Yeah, that's one of our classic recipes. That I think they also serve it at the pizzeria too.
Yeah.
That's a great recipe. I looked at the old Serious Eats book, which is out of print. It has 50 Kenji Lopez Alt recipes, which I'm sure you'd redo if you did them again. Triple chocolate adult brownies. Your old apple pie recipe, chocolate chip cookies, and you're right, vanilla macaroons.
That Serious Eats book, though, that's the first place that the halal cart chicken and rice recipe, which I think is also like one of my two most popular recipes. I wrote that for that book.
Yeah.
I'm sure it's available for free on Serious Eats now as well.
You know that that book came out in 2011, so it's going to celebrate a 10-year anniversary coming up in 2021.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's it for now, but Kenji will be back in the new year to answer Serious Eaters' questions. And have a great holiday season, my friend. And much love to your wife and wonderful daughter.
All right, thanks.
That's it for this episode of Special Sauce. We'll be back next year with new episodes every 2 weeks. In the meantime, please stay safe and healthy this holiday season. And again, I urge you to do everything you can to support your local restaurants and the purveyors that supply them. The pandemic has wreaked havoc on the restaurants we all know and love. Sadly, the latest COVID relief package passed by Congress doesn't do nearly enough for those restaurants. You can help save your local restaurants by donating to SaveRestaurants.com. And if you can afford it, order directly from those very same restaurants rather than using the popular delivery apps. Or donate to worthy organizations like No Kid Hungry or Feeding America, both of which combat the food insecurity an estimated 54 million Americans are suffering from during the pandemic. So long, serious eaters. Happy holidays from Special Sauce.
Special Sauce is a production of Dot Dash, produced by John Kalish and Ed Levine. Theme music by Charlie Morrow for Morrow Sound.